Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a fascinating piece of source material and, well, really distill the core knowledge and those aha moments you're looking for.
All without getting totally bogged down in the weeds.
Exactly. If you're curious and want to get a solid grasp of something quickly, you're definitely in the right place.
And today we're diving into Episode 9, Sky Raider Stories, Vietnam's Secret Air Missions. It's from the Military Tales channel over on YouTube.
Right. So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the key insights and honestly, some really surprising stuff about the air war over the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
And particularly the role of the A1 Sky Raider.
Yes, absolutely. We're focusing on the A1 story, and what makes this source, Episode 9, so valuable is that it's a firsthand account. We're hearing directly from someone who flew these incredibly tough missions.
Yeah, and what's interesting right off the bat is the speaker's background. He wasn't just an A1 pilot. He flew OV-10 Broncos, too, in Vietnam.
And you can tell his passion for aviation didn't stop there. He's still involved with classic aircraft, even runs a business restoring them.
And his wider career is pretty impressive, too. Commanded an F-15 squadron, was an aggressor pilot.
Simulating enemy tactics, right. But his initial reason for wanting the Sky Raider, it seems, was this connection he felt to World War II history.
He saw it as a chance to fly a piece of that history, basically.
Which really shows how personal interests can shape these military paths. Even with jets available, history pulled him towards the A1. But then things took a strange turn, didn't they?
Oh, definitely. A real curveball. After A1 flight school, he and the other new lieutenants were told, essentially, that they were too inept to fly the Sky Raider right away.
Wow. So they got reassigned to the OV-10 Bronco instead.
But he was determined. He specifically asked to be a forward air controller, a FAC, at Nakhon Phanom NKP in Thailand.
Because that's where the Sky Raiders were based. He was hoping to eventually get back to them.
Exactly. So let's talk about that OV-10 Bronco experience for a bit. As he describes it, it's a twin turboprop, mostly used for forward air control at NKP.
And its setup there was pretty standard for a FAC centerline fuel tank, some machine guns and rocket pods, usually smoke or maybe some high explosive ones.
What's really striking, though, is how basic the navigation was.
Yeah, he stresses that. No GPS, no inertial navigation systems like we rely on today.
It was all down to basic instruments, paper maps, and dead reckoning.
It's just incredible skill needed. Imagine navigating over dense jungle, maybe at night, just calculating position based on speed, time, and direction. The room for error must have been tiny.
Absolutely. It highlights the raw skill involved. And connecting this to the bigger picture, he makes a really crucial point early on. The main air war during his time there wasn't really fought over Vietnam itself.
Right, it was over Laos.
He paints this picture of Laos, thick, triple canopy jungle, these dramatic karst mountains, almost no roads or infrastructure.
And this terrain was perfect for hiding the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Which wasn't just a single trail, of course. You have to picture this huge, complex network.
Like a hidden highway system.
Exactly. Dirt roads, tracks, pathways, all used by North Vietnam to move massive amounts of supplies and troops south to fuel the war effort.
The scale is just mind-boggling. He mentions estimates of maybe 3,000 trucks moving on the trail every night.
And they operated cleverly in short segments, maybe 10, 15 miles, with drivers who knew just their little part of the route.
And the North Vietnamese were masters at concealment, camouflage everywhere, spider holes for troops to hide in during attacks.
Monitoring Allied radio frequencies, using light signals. It was sophisticated. They even had fuel pipelines running alongside or buried near the trail.
But the anti-aircraft defenses, that's what really stands out. He compares the density of guns along the trail to heavily defended areas in central Germany during World War II.
Over 10,000 anti-aircraft guns estimated along that route. Just think about that density.
And the amount of bombs dropped trying to stop it, something like 3 million tons on the Ho Chi Minh Trail alone. It shows the intensity of this almost secret air war over Laos.
So given that environment, the job of the OV-10 FAC was incredibly dangerous and demanding.
Patrolling that whole 700-mile stretch of trail, day and night, looking for any sign of activity.
And they often had to fly higher up because of the ground fire risk, relying on binoculars.
Trying to spot tiny clues from altitude straight lines, square angles suggesting vehicles, maybe a small vegetable patch indicating an encampment.
Or disturbances in the water at crossings. All while flying, navigating by map and landmark, and trying not to get shot down.
And when they did spot something, they'd mark it, usually with smoke rockets, for the fighter jets coming in.
It was a constant, high-stakes game of cat and mouse.
He also gives us a sense of life at NKP itself. Located right on the Mekong River, looking across at Laos.
The contrast must have been stark. Thailand, relatively peaceful, while just across the river was the war zone.
Despite the crazy mission tempo he mentions, flying about 60 combat hours a month, there was still a social side. Drinking beers down by the river, the tradition of these elaborate party suits.
And that little anecdote about the squadron pet, a pig named I'm a Dog.
Yeah, adds a touch of, well, dark humor, maybe. Shows the kind of bonding that happens in those intense situations.
Then there's the story of Thunder Chicken. What a name. Leonard J. Funkerberg Thunderbird.
An A-1 pilot with a unique method for finding enemy gun positions.
Unique and incredibly dangerous. You wouldn't try spotting them from high up. No, he'd fly down at treetop level.
Literally looking for the glint off hidden gun barrels in the jungle. It sounds almost suicidal.
Right. Then he'd pop back up, call on the location, and guide laser-guided bombs onto the target.
His bravery, or maybe as the speaker jokes, his madness, got him recognized for it.
It really shows the kind of unorthodox tactics pilots developed on the ground to deal with these immense challenges.
Speaking of challenges, finding trucks during the day under that thick jungle canopy was a huge problem.
Which led to some interesting experiments. They tried using modified Navy sonobuoys, you know, the things used to detect submarines.
Dropped them along the trail disguised as logs, hoping to pick up the sound of trucks.
And they used modified beach bonanzas called Q-22Bs, flying high above to relay the signals back.
But as he points out, without someone on the ground to actually see what was making the noise, its usefulness was kind of limited.
It just underscores how hard it was fighting an enemy you often couldn't even see.
Which brings us to MACV, SOG, the Military Assistance Command, Vietnam Studies and Observations Group. Highly secret stuff.
Operating out of their own guarded compound at NKP, nicknamed Heavy Hook.
Their main job involved these prairie fire missions, inserting small recon teams deep onto the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
These weren't just Americans. Teams were often a mix of U.S. Special Forces, South Vietnamese soldiers, local Hi Hmong tribesmen who knew the area.
And even North Vietnamese defectors called kit cars, recruited by the CIA, all trying to gather intel or even snatch prisoners.
And certain Air Force FACs, like the speaker, were designated Prairie Fire FACs. They supported these missions directly.
A very dangerous job. He mentions losing friends who flew those missions. The SOG guys specifically requested pilots they trusted because the risks were so high.
Insertions and extractions were hairy. CH-53 helicopters, big Jolly Greens going in low and fast, with A-1 Sky Raiders flying escort, guns ready.
And if a team got compromised, they'd call a prairie fire emergency.
That meant basically every available Allied aircraft in the region dropped what they were doing and raced to help extract the team.
Sometimes they couldn't even land. They'd drop ropes and literally drag guys out through the jungle canopy.
Just incredibly perilous. And the high loss rate for OV-10s, mostly over Laos, really speaks to the intensity of these secret ops.
So eventually, the speaker gets his chance to go back to the aircraft. This episode is really about the A-1 Sky Raider.
Right. He joins the 1st Special Operations Squadron, the Hobos, also at NKP.
And this happened partly because the Air Force, well, they'd run low on experienced A-1 pilots because of that initial policy against assigning lieutenants.
Their loss was his gain, in a way.
And he was clearly blown away by the A-1's capabilities. He compares it to a B-17 from World War II.
In terms of bomb load, yeah. It could carry up to 8,000 pounds of ordnance. And it could stay over a target area for a long, long time.
It was originally designed way back to replace the Dauntless Dive Bomber, saw action in Korea, even hunted submarines early on.
The Navy used them extensively before jets took over, which leads to that legendary story.
The toilet bomb! Apparently, a Navy pilot dropped a damaged toilet on North Vietnam as a sort of statement.
You hear these stories. And incredibly, an A-1 actually shot down a MiG-17 jet.
Amazing for a propeller plane. The Air Force saw its value for counterinsurgency, used them to train South Vietnamese pilots, and then flew them themselves.
But its most vital role, especially later in the war, became search and rescue, SAR.
The Sandy mission.
Exactly. The Sandy package A-1s escorting the Jolly Green rescue helicopters. They were absolutely critical for pulling down airmen out of hostile areas.
The A-1's ability to lay down really accurate fire right around a survivor on the ground was often the key to getting them out alive.
He describes the A-1's cockpit panel, the weapons controls, as super complex, nicknamed the Wurlitzer, like the Oregon.
But the typical Sandy loadout was interesting. They deliberately avoided big, high-explosive bombs.
Right, because you don't want to accidentally hit the person you're trying to save.
So they used the 20-millimeter cannons, the 7.62 millimeter Gatling gun pods, miniguns, rockets, cluster bombs for suppressing enemy troops.
And white phosphorus rockets, mainly for marking. WP Willie Pete.
His stories of sitting alert duty at places like Da Nang, ready to scramble for a rescue, really bring that role to life.
He also shares some great details about the A1 itself, like how operational ones are always greasy, dirty, stained.
Not like the shiny restored ones you see at air shows today. He said the pilots' flight suits were permanently stained and smelled of oil and hydraulic fluid.
And a weird story about getting loaded with a strange mix of fragmentation cluster bombs one time.
He also mentions the A1 had a fairly high crash rate. Not just combat losses, but operational accidents, too.
Which is why the Pedro helicopter, basically a flying fire extinguisher, was always nearby on takeoff and landing.
And the ejection system, the Yankee seat, which used a rocket.
He says its reliability was questionable.
There was a manual bailout procedure, too, which sounds terrifying in itself. He mentioned seeing a crew chief's log showing just how many aircraft the squadron had lost over time.
Really sobering stuff.
He gives us a feel for the squadron life, too. The long hooches where they lived, the central party hooch for gatherings.
Little traditions like wearing your name tag upside down sometimes.
And collecting bent propellers from crashed planes as garden ornaments. Grim, but part of the culture.
They even painted one of the aircraft shelters, the revetments, to look like the front of an A1.
He tallied up his own service, 161 combat missions, 608 combat hours. That's a lot of time under fire.
And that tradition of the Jolly Green Cruise, painting green footprints on a departing sandy pilot's pants. A sign of respect between crews who relied on each other.
The story doesn't end with the U.S. withdrawal, though. What happened to the A1s after Saigon fell in 75 is fascinating.
A lot of South Vietnamese pilots flew their remaining A1s out to Utapao Air Base in Thailand to escape the North Vietnamese advance.
And then the speaker himself, Roger Youngblood, along with another former A1 pilot, got passed to go retrieve some of them.
They flew four of those abandoned A1s from Utapao to another base, Tak Li, basically saving them.
Incredible. And he says two of those very planes are still around today, preserved in a hangar.
It really puts the numbers in perspective. Around 200 A1s served in Vietnam, but 159 were lost in combat.
So they weren't retired just because they were old. They were lost fighting.
And that almost unbelievable story of 8 American pilots volunteering to go back into South Vietnam after the official pullout to try and fly out even more stranded A1s, the dedication to that aircraft was immense.
But underlying all this is the human cost. He's very clear about the risks.
Extremely high risk for A1 pilots. He estimates about 1 in 5 were shot down during their tour.
And the USAF stats are stark. Out of roughly 700 pilots who flew the A1 in combat, 106 were killed. That's about a 1 in 7 chance of not coming home.
He talks about his friends who were lost, holds an event every Veterans Day. Mm. It clearly stays with him.
You can hear the pride in his voice, though. Pride in being a Vietnam combat veteran, and also pride in his daughter, who became an Air Force pilot herself.
A powerful legacy.
The episode ends with these haunting images. Ghostly pictures, he calls them, of Laos today.
Decades later, the landscape still bears the scars. The Ho Chi Minh Trail, largely untouched.
You see abandoned tanks, wrecked planes, bulldozers just rusting away in the jungle.
And then this image of transformation. A huge bomb crater turned into a fish farm by local villagers.
Yeah.
Life finding a way.
But the final image, Laotian tribesmen using an old American pilot's helmet.
Yeah, a really stark, poignant reminder of the human element, the individual stories caught up in it all, and how artifacts of war get absorbed into everyday life afterwards.
Well, thank you for taking this deep dive with us into Sky Raider stories, specifically episode 9 from Military Tales. We've definitely uncovered some surprising details about that air war over Laos.
And the truly unique, absolutely vital role the A1 Sky Raider played, especially in search and rescue.
What really comes through in this episode, I think, is the power of that firsthand perspective. You get the technical side, sure, but also the ingenuity, the camaraderie.
And the very real human cost involved. It's not just about machines, it's about the people who flew them and the risks they took.
Absolutely. And maybe a final thought to leave you with. Think about that lasting impact, not just the craters and wreckage we saw in those photos from Laos, but the deeper impact on individuals, on cultures that lingers long after the fighting stops. That image of the helmet,
yeah.
It really makes you think, doesn't it?
It really does. We definitely encourage you, if you can, to check out the original Episode 9 Sky Raider stories on the Military Tales channel to see those images and hear the full account directly.